No soul had warmed the Lycan King's grieving wolf in 3 years, until she laid a hand on his heart. I had not entered the lower hall of Ironskate in 3 years. Not since the night my wolf Verath first refused to move, the night I came down to find him lying with his great silver head pressed flat against the stone, his amber eyes locked on nothing I could see. That was the night I understood that grief does not spare wolves. It only changes its shape. My Luna, Alara, had died in the season's turning, a fever that came in 3 days and took her in 4. She was 27 years old. She was the warmest soul the Northern Pax had ever seen, and when she left, Verath, the wolf I had carried for 31 years, the beast who had brought a war council to its knees with one look, simply stopped. He would not shift. He would not eat. He would suffer no healer near him, no keeper, no council elder with their herbs and their quiet voices. 3 came away bleeding. The 4th I did not send. I ruled without him. I sat in the great hall and signed the documents and settled the pact disputes, and I did all the things a Lycan king must do, and all the while the lower hall was locked and quiet, and I did not go in. Until the morning, a wolfless girl from the eastern quarter of Ironskate laid her hand on his heart and made him breathe again. This is how it happened, and I will not leave a word of it out. She arrived in the keep not as a guest. She came in the back way, with the new season's healers and kitchen staff, the third wave of hires that my steward Brennan assembled after the first 2 batches proved unsuitable. I did not know her name. I knew only that she was assigned to the lower corridors, to the cleaning and the linen stores, because she had presented herself at the hiring table without a wolf's shift, and Brennan, a careful, rule-keeping man, had written wolfless, limited duties in his ledger and sent her below stairs. That was where the pack of Ironskate put those like her. Not out in the cold, not turned away at the gate, but placed quietly out of sight, given tasks that required no pack rank, and left to their usefulness and nothing more. Her name was Senna. I did not learn this for 6 days. On the first day she was in the keep, I was in the war room with my 3-pack masters reviewing the border reports from the north. I did not see her arrive. On the second day I crossed the main courtyard, and a handful of servants bowed and moved aside, and I did not look at any particular face. On the third day I was in the healer's wing because one of my young wolves had taken a wound in training, and she was in the corridor outside with a stack of fresh linen, and I walked past her without stopping. She pressed herself flat against the wall in the way that people without pack rank learn to do when a king walks past, making themselves very small, very still, barely there, and I did not look. I am ashamed of that now, but I am telling you what was true. On the 4th night, I heard Verath. Not his howl. Verath had not howled in 3 years. He had not made any sound at all except the low, flat rasp of labored breathing that I had learned to identify from the far end of the corridor, through a closed door, at 30 paces. I knew that sound the way you know the sound of your own heartbeat, constant, irregular in the worst moments, a thing you learn to live alongside without letting yourself think about it too hard. What I heard on the 4th night was different. I was in my study at the end of the upper wing, reading by the fire with a cup of something warm that was supposed to help me sleep. The keep was quiet. My guard had changed an hour before. Outside, snow was falling on the stone battlements in the slow, steady way of northern winter, no storm, just the weight of it settling. And then, from somewhere very far below, I heard a sound that stopped me mid-breath. A low, resonant exhale, not a rasp, not distress, something slower and deeper and almost easy. I set down my cup. I sat still for a long time, telling myself I had imagined it. My wolf had not breathed that way in 3 years. The sound I knew from his direction was smaller than that, careful, compressed, like a creature trying to take up as little space as possible. What I had just heard was the sound of a large, living thing letting a long breath out. The sound of something relaxing. I did not go down that night. I was afraid of what I would find, and that is a thing a king does not say easily. I was afraid to open that door and find Verath exactly as I had left him, and no, the sound I'd heard was only my own longing wearing his voice. I went down on the fifth morning. The lower hall was empty. Verath was where he always was, in the back corner of the great stone enclosure, his bulk against the wall, his silver coat dull with long inactivity. His ears were flat. His eyes were half closed. But and I stood very still in the doorway and simply watched. His breathing was not the compressed, careful rasp I had come to know. He was breathing long and slow, in and out, the rhythm of a sleeping wolf, not a grieving one. I stepped forward. He raised his head and looked at me, and the amber of his eyes was still and quiet, and he did not move away. That was the most he had allowed from me in 6 months. I crouched down at a distance that felt safe, and I watched him for a long time, and I could not make any sense of what I was seeing. He had not let a healer near him. He had not let Brennan in the room. He had not, for the last several months, even allowed the young keeper boy who brought his water to linger. And now he was lying there in the morning light with his great head resting on his forepaws, and his breath moving in and out like something in him had come very slightly loose. I went back upstairs and I said nothing to anyone, but I placed a request with Brennan that the lower hall be given a thorough clean, the linen stores, the corridor, the outer stone passage. I said I wanted it done quietly and during the day, not at night. I said I wanted no crowd of staff, just one person, and I wanted them to work without rushing. Brennan sent Senna. I do not believe he thought about it. She was assigned below stairs. She was quiet and unobtrusive and caused no difficulty. She would not need to go into the enclosure itself, just the passage, the corridor, the outer door. He sent her down with a pail and a mop and a stack of clean rags, and he told her to be quick and not to bother the wolf. I watched from the upper gallery. I do not think she knew I was there. She came down the corridor with her pail and her rags, and she moved with the kind of efficiency that speaks of long practice at being useful in places where no one wants you to take too long. She worked the outer passage first, stone flags, the low benches along the wall, the window ledges. She did not hum. She did not talk to herself. She simply worked, and the work was good, and the corridor filled with the clean smell of cold water and rough soap. Then she reached the outer door of Verath's enclosure. She stood at the door for a moment. Through the iron grate she could see him, that enormous silver shape in the corner, the amber eyes already watching her. I saw her go still, not with fear exactly, something more considered than fear. She was looking at him the way you look at something that has asked you a question, trying to decide on your answer. She set down her pail. She sat down on the stone floor outside the grate, not standing, not hovering, but actually sat down with her knees drawn up and her back against the wall and her hands loose in her lap. And she waited. Verath raised his head. I stopped breathing. He was looking at her the way he had not looked at anything alive in 3 years, with attention, with focus, with something that was not quite recognition, but was not dismissal either. He looked at her the way a great old wolf looks at a fire when he is cold, wary, assessing, wanting without wanting to admit to wanting. She did not move, she did not speak. She simply sat there on the stone floor outside the grate and let him look. After a while, and I counted the minutes because I could not stop counting, there were 11 of them, Verath stood up. Not all at once. Slowly, in the careful way of a large creature that has not moved much in a long time, like joints that need reminding how to work. He stood up and he walked across the enclosure, and he stopped 2 wolf lengths from the grate, and he looked at her from that distance. She looked back. He lowered his head and pressed his nose to the iron grate. She lifted one hand, very slowly, with no quick movements, with no announcement of what she was doing, and she pressed her palm flat against the grate where his nose rested. The sound that came out of Verath then was not a growl and was not a howl, and was not any sound I had heard from him in 3 years. It was low and long, and it resonated off the stone walls of the passage, and it went up through the floor of the gallery above, and it filled my chest like something being poured in. He was not in pain, he was not warning her, he was simply breathing. She kept her hand against the grate. She did not pull away. She did not lean in. She just held the contact, light and steady, and Vareth stood there with his nose pressed to her palm and made that slow, resonant sound, and I stood on the gallery above them and gripped the balustrade and tried to remember how to inhale. I went down at the end of her shift. She was collecting her pail and her rags from the outer passage when I appeared in the doorway, and she startled, dropped the pail, caught it, pressed herself back against the wall with her chin down and her hands at her sides in that practiced, self-erasing posture. Her eyes were on the floor. She was waiting for me to speak first. "Your name," I said. "Senna," her voice was quiet, not frightened, just careful. "From the Eastern Quarter, my king. I came with the third wave of staff. Brennan assigned me to the lower corridors." "I know," I said. "I sent you." She raised her eyes then, just slightly, and looked at me for a fraction of a second before looking down again. Assessing. Recalibrating. "You sat outside his enclosure," I said. "For 11 minutes. She was quiet for a moment. Then, he looked like he needed someone to sit with him. A pause. Not to do anything, just to sit. Every healer I sent to him came away hurt. I didn't go in, a beat. I wouldn't have gone in without permission." I looked at her. She had brown hair pulled back with a plain tie, and her dress was the unbleached linen of lower staff, and she had a red mark on the side of her right hand where the rough stone of the grate had pressed during those 11 minutes. She did not have the broad-shouldered ease of a woman with a wolf behind her eyes. There was no glimmer of a second form, no faint amber or silver or gold in her gaze that every shifted wolf carries as a trace of their other self. She was simply herself. Quiet and still and very present. "Come back tomorrow," I said. She looked at me fully then, just for a moment. Her eyes were dark gray and very direct, and what I saw in them was not eagerness, not ambition, not even relief. Just something careful and honest and entirely unhurried. "Yes, my king," she said. She picked up her pail and her rags and she walked back down the corridor, and I stood in the doorway of the lower hall with Vareth breathing behind me, that new, slow, full breath, and my own chest doing something I did not have a name for yet.
Really?
She came back the next day, and the day after that, and the day after that. I did not tell Brennan. I did not tell the Packmasters or the Council or the Healers Guild. I reassigned her from the linen stores to the lower corridor, citing maintenance, and I noted it in my own hand in the household ledger so that it would be filed and forgotten, and no one asked questions. What she did was very simple, and it was the same each time. She came to the outer passage in the morning after her other duties were complete. She set down her pail. She sat on the stone floor outside the grate with her knees up and her hands loose, and she waited. And every morning Vareth came a little sooner, a little more steadily, a little less careful in his movement. By the sixth morning of her visits, he was already waiting at the grate when she arrived. On the seventh morning, he was lying down in front of it, his enormous silver head resting on his forepaws, his amber eyes on the door at the end of the corridor. Waiting for her. On the eighth morning, I unlocked the inner door. I did not tell her I had done it. I came down before she arrived and I stood the door open, not all the way, just the width of a hand, and I went back to the gallery above and I watched. She came at her usual time with her pail and her rags and she stopped at the outer door and looked at the open inner one for a long, quiet moment. I saw her decide. She set down the pail. She opened the outer grate herself, carefully, making no sharp sounds. She went through and crouched down just inside the enclosure, against the wall, with the door behind her, and all the open stone and dim light of the room between her and Vareth. He lifted his head, looked at her, and got up. He crossed the enclosure in 4 paces, and he stopped in front of her, and he lowered his great silver head to her level. And he looked at her from a distance of perhaps 2 feet, which was close enough that I could see his breath making faint clouds in the cold air between them. She lifted her hand. She pressed her palm gently to the side of his jaw. He closed his eyes. I have led armies. I have stood in the ruins of burned villages, and I have held men together with nothing but my voice. I have made decisions that cost lives, and I have lived with those decisions, and I thought I had become a person who did not weep easily. I was wrong. I found this out on the morning Senna sat on the floor of the lower hall and pressed her palm to Varath's jaw, and he closed his eyes, because I stood on the gallery above them, and I wept like a man who had been holding his breath for 3 years, and only just remembered how to let it out. He made that sound again, low and long and resonant. She kept her hand against his jaw. She was talking to him, I realized. I could not hear the words from the gallery, but I could see the movement of her lips, very quiet, and his ears moved forward to catch it. He was listening to her. I went downstairs. I stood in the doorway of the inner room, and she looked up at me without removing her hand from his jaw, and I looked back at her, and Varath opened one amber eye and regarded me with an expression I had not seen on my wolf in 3 years. Mild, contained, entirely at ease. "What are you saying to him?" I asked. She thought about it. "I was telling him about the snow," she said, "outside the east corridor window this morning. The light was very particular. The new snow had a kind of blue in it from the sky, and it made the inner courtyard look like the bottom of the sea. I told him about it." I looked at my wolf. He had both eyes open now, watching me with the patient attention of a creature who has all the time in the world and intends to use it. "He doesn't understand words," I said. "He understands the intention behind them," she said simply. "It's not very different." I stood there in the doorway for a long time. Then I sat down on the bench beside the inner door, the old stone bench where I had sat many times in the first months after Alara died, trying to reach him, coming away with nothing. And I looked at the two of them, the enormous grieving wolf and the small wolfless girl from the eastern quarter, and I said, "May I stay?" She looked at me for a moment with those direct gray eyes. Then she said, "Of course, my king." We stayed for 2 hours. Senna talked, not constantly, not nervously, but in the way of someone who has learned to fill silence with the right things and no more. She told Varath about the hawk she had seen on the battlements. She told him about the kitchen garden the staff had started in the inner courtyard, the frozen herbs still in their beds waiting for spring. Once she asked me, without any particular ceremony, whether he had ever liked to run in the hills to the north or whether he was more of a forest wolf, and the question caught me so off guard that I answered it before I thought about it. "He was a hills wolf," I said. "He always ran highest when there was nothing blocking the sky." She nodded thoughtfully and filed this away, and then she told Varath about the hill line she had seen from the upper window on a clear day. The long ridge to the north that you could just make out on good mornings, pale and faint against the sky, like a promise. He was asleep before she finished. We sat there together in the quiet, the wolfless girl and the lichen king, with the great silver wolf breathing long and steady between us. And outside the snow went on falling, and I could not have told you the last time I had sat still in a room and felt anything other than the hollow weight of unfinished grief. I want to be honest about the next part. I did not fall in love quickly. I want to say that, because there are stories that are told too fast, and what I feel for Senna is the kind of thing that should not be rushed in the telling. What I felt first was gratitude, enormous, almost unbearable gratitude, the kind that makes you awkward and overcareful because you are afraid of what you will do with it if you look at it directly. And underneath that gratitude was something older and quieter, something that had been sitting in the room with me for longer than I could account for, waiting for me to notice it. She came every morning for 3 weeks, and in those 3 weeks I came down most mornings too, not always at the beginning, sometimes in the middle, once near the end when she had already risen to leave. I told myself I was monitoring the situation. I told myself I needed to see for myself the progress Verath was making. I told myself many things that were all technically true and also entirely beside the point. What the truth was, I wanted to be in the room where Senna was. She was not soft. I want to be clear about that. She was not the fragile, self-effacing creature that the pack of Ironskate had decided she was when they saw she carried no wolf. There was something in her that was simply level, even, like the surface of a lake on a calm day, not shallow, not without depth, just not throwing anything up unless there was a reason. She had opinions and she shared them when I asked, and she did not apologize for them or couch them in, perhaps my king might consider. She said what she thought. She was wrong sometimes. When I told her so, she considered it and either adjusted her view or explained why she had not, and either way there was no drama. She was not afraid of me, and she was not pretending not to be afraid. She was genuinely, practically, interestedly unafraid, the way you are when you have sat on a cold stone floor opposite an enormous silver wolf for 3 weeks and taken the full measure of something much more frightening than a king. One morning she said to me, while she was braiding a section of Verath's fur where it had matted from long inactivity, "The pack calls me hollow." I looked at her. "The Eastern Quarter," she said, "the common staff. They say a woman without a wolf's heart is a woman without a real heart, that we go through the motions without feeling anything." She did not say this with bitterness or with any appeal to my sympathy. She said it in the same way she told Verath about the weather, as a fact she was examining, turning over, deciding what to do with. They said it about me in the village where I grew up too. I've heard it most of my life. "And," I said. She looked up at me with those gray eyes. "And I've watched Verath for 3 weeks," she said. "He has no speech. He has no hands. He cannot write his grief down or argue his case or perform his feeling for an audience. He simply carries it here." She pressed her palm flat against the wolf's flank where his great heart beats slow and steady under her hand. "And everyone who sees him knows it's real." A pause. I thought that was worth noting. I sat very still. She went back to her braiding, unhurried, and Verath breathed under her hand. And I thought about all the ways I had looked past her in the corridors of my own keep. Walked past. Moved past. Registered her as linen and usefulness and not quite visible, while she had been carrying all of that in her chest, and offering it quietly to my wolf, because he was the only one in the building who could not be told to dismiss her. I said, "I was wrong to put you below stairs." She looked at me again. There was a careful pause, and then she said, "Brennan put me below stairs. I made the system Brennan follows." She thought about this. "Then yes," she said, "that's fair." She was quiet for another moment. Then, not bitterly, just honestly, the way she said everything, "It isn't only Ironskate. Every pack I've come through has a place for people like me. Not outside and not inside. A kind of middle space where you are useful enough to keep and unremarkable enough to ignore." She smoothed the fur under her hand, long, slow strokes. "I came here because the pay was fair and the distance was right, and I thought, one more place, one more ledger entry that says wolfless, limited duties, and then I'll find something different. A village, perhaps, that has less use for the distinction." She paused, "and then Brennan sent me down to the corridor." "And then you sat on the floor," I said. "And then I sat on the floor," she agreed. The faintest thing, not quite a smile, but close to it. "He was the first one who didn't ask me what I was before he decided whether I was worth a second look." We looked at each other for a moment. Verath turned his head and pressed his nose to the inside of her wrist, and I saw the thing that happened then, the brief, involuntary closing of her eyes, the small intake of breath, the expression of something that was not quite pain and not quite relief but lived somewhere between the two, and I thought, she has been waiting a very long time for someone to see her. Not the gap where the wolf should be, her. And I thought, I am looking at her now. My hand was warm. Not the warmth of the fire or the warmth of the room, the warmth that starts in the chest and spreads out through the limbs, that every lichen learns to identify as the bond's first signal. a warmth I had not felt since Ilara. I looked down at the inside of my right wrist. The mark there, the mate mark I had shared with Ilara that had gone dim and cold when she died, was not cold anymore. It was faint, very faint, barely a trace, but it was lit. The faintest possible gold, like a coal that has not quite gone out. I pulled my sleeve down. I did not tell her, not yet. I was not ready is not the right word. I was not sure. Not of the mark, which I could feel as plainly as I could feel my own pulse, but sure enough of myself, of whether I was a man who deserved to ask her for anything, given what I had looked past, given the system I had built and the place it had put her. I was not sure I had earned the right. It was the council that forced the matter. I should have known it would come. Ironskate ran on information, the way all pack courts do, and 3 weeks of the Lycan King going down to the lower hall each morning before his council appointments had not gone unnoticed. Brennan was not a gossip, but he was thorough, and thorough men have thorough clerks, and thorough clerks talk. By the end of the third week, Packmaster Edric had heard enough to present himself in my study one evening with a grave face and a cup of tea. He sat down with the careful courtesy of a man who has a difficult thing to say. "There are concerns," Edric said, "in the council." "There are always concerns in the council," I said. "About the wolfless girl, the one from the Eastern Quarter," he paused. "There are some who say she has put a working on the wolf, some charm or influence." I looked at him. Varath has improved more in 3 weeks than he did in 3 years of the Healers Guild working on him, I said. "Do the Healers Guild believe they were charmed?" Edric had the grace to pause. "No," he said, "they are puzzled." "Good," I said, "they should be. Puzzled people think." "Have Brennan move her quarters from the lower hall to the east wing guest corridor." Edric stared at me. "My king." "And adjust her staff designation to keeper of the lower hall and the wolf enclosure. Give her the appropriate rank and wages for that post." I picked up my pen. "She has been doing the work without the recognition or the compensation. That is not how this keep operates." There was a long silence. Edric said very carefully, "She is wolfless, my king. The lower staff will not." "The lower staff," I said, "will do as they are told and find something more useful to be concerned about." Edric left. I sat at my desk for a while after he was gone, looking at the inside of my right wrist through my sleeve, feeling the faint, steady warmth of it. Then I went down to the lower hall. She was still there. It was past her usual hour, but she was sitting with Varath in the enclosure with a small lantern, reading aloud from a thin book of northern fables. She looked up when I came in and started to rise, and I said, "Don't. I'll sit." I sat on the stone bench. Varath looked at me with his amber eyes and then settled his head back on his paws with the air of a wolf who has assessed the situation and found it acceptable. She looked at me, measuring something. "They're going to make this complicated," she said. "Not a question." "They've started," I said. "The council has concerns." "They think I'm a charmer." There was almost something wry in her voice. I heard one of the junior clerks say it in the corridor. "Do they?" I said. I looked at her steadily. "Are you?" She met my gaze completely level. "No," she said. "I sat with him. That's all. It is not unusual for grief to break a little when someone sits with it rather than trying to fix it." A pause. "Although I know that does not explain it to the satisfaction of the Healers Guild." "No," I said, "it doesn't explain it to their satisfaction." She looked at the book in her hand for a moment. Then she looked at me. "My king," she said, with a deliberateness that told me she had been thinking about it, "if this is causing you difficulty with the council, I am content to simply come in the mornings before the hall is busy and go back to the lower corridor after. There is no need to." "I've moved your quarters to the east wing," I said. She stopped. "And changed your staff designation to keeper of the lower hall, with the corresponding rank and wages." I kept my voice level. "You have been doing the work without either. That was an error in the ledger, and I've corrected it." She looked at me for a long moment. The lantern light was warm on her face and she was very still, and I could see her recalibrating. The way she had in the corridor on the first evening, carefully, without dramatics. "That is generous," she said at last. "It is accurate," I said. "There is a difference." She considered this. Then quietly, "Thank you, my king." We sat there for a while longer in the lantern light, the three of us, the lichen king who had been hollow in his own way for 3 years, the wolfless girl who had been called hollow all her life, and the great silver wolf who had taught us both something about the shape of grief and the shape of healing. Outside, the northern wind moved over the stone walls of Ironsgate, and inside, the lantern held.
Really?
The pack reacted as I had expected. Brennan was efficient and professionally neutral, as he always was. The junior clerks whispered. Three of the lower hall staff requested reassignment, which I approved without comment, and their posts were filled within the week by people who had no strong feelings about the wolfless girl's new designation. Packmaster Aldrich, the eldest of my three, a man of 61 years who had served my father and who expressed disapproval, the way other men breathed, constantly and without particular drama, came to my study and sat in the chair across from my desk and looked at me for a long time before speaking. "You know what the pack will say," he said. "I expect they'll say several things," I said. "They'll say she has bewitched the wolf. They'll say a wolfless woman has no right to a position of trust. They'll say the king is not thinking clearly." He paused. "Some of them will say worse." "They will say what they say," I agreed. "And then they will say it to fewer people, and then they will stop, because the wolf will go on improving and the work will go on being done well, and there will be nothing to sustain the talk." Aldrich looked at his hands, then at me. "Alara has been gone 3 years," he said, not unkindly. "No one questions your right to." "This is not what you are implying," I said. "My king, she is the keeper of the wolf enclosure and the lower hall," I said. "She is good at her work and she has been compensated accurately for it. That is all that has happened. I would ask you to speak to anyone who suggests otherwise and correct their misapprehension." Aldrich looked at me for a moment with the tired shrewdness of an old pack master who has seen 3 decades of kings make decisions they say are one thing and mean another. He did not push. He rose, bowed, and left. I sat back in my chair and looked at the inside of my right wrist. The mark was not faint anymore. It had been strengthening for a week, not blazing, not the full force heat of a first bond igniting in youth, but steady and certain, the way an old fire that has been banked all winter returns when the season turns. A deep gold, lit through the skin, pulsing with every heartbeat. I had not told her. I needed to. I knew I needed to. But this was not the first mate mark I had carried, and Senna was not a woman who would be swept away by grand gestures. She was level and careful, and she had been dismissed by everyone she had ever trusted the judgment of, and I was not going to announce the bond to her like a verdict and expect her to be grateful. That was not what she deserved. That was not who I wanted to be in the story of how this happened. So I chose a morning.
Really?
She was in the enclosure when I came down, as she usually was. Vareth was standing at the far end, fully alert, ears up, head high, moving with a fluid ease that had been entirely absent from him for 3 years. He had been going out into the courtyard for 3 days now. On the second day, he had run just a short sprint from one end of the inner yard to the other. And then he had come back and stood in front of Senna and panted, and she had laughed, and the sound of it had been so unguarded and warm that every servant in earshot had turned to look. He was not the wolf he had been before Alara. That wolf was woven through with her. The years of their bond had changed him, and her absence had changed him again, and he would carry both. But he was living. He was present. He was choosing every morning to get up and come to the door and wait for her step in the corridor. That is what healing looks like, I think. Not forgetting, not returning to before. Just choosing to come to the door again. She was brushing the remaining matted patches from his coat when I came in, working through a section at his shoulder with the kind of careful patience that has no impatience in it at all. She glanced at me when I entered and nodded once, her usual greeting, and went back to her work. Vareth flicked one ear at me and stayed put. I sat on the bench for a while and watched, and then I said, "There is something I need to tell you." She kept brushing, but her attention shifted. "All right," she said. I pulled up my right sleeve. The mate mark was fully lit, gold, clear, pulsing, the warm sovereign color of a bond in full waking. It had been this bright for 2 days. It was not going to wait much longer. She looked at it for a long moment, the brush still in her hand. Her face was very still. "I know what that is," she said. "I know you do," I said. "When did it?" "It began perhaps 4 weeks ago," I said. "In this room, when Vareth pressed his nose to your wrist for the first time." I kept my voice level and my sleeve rolled up and my eyes on her face. "I have not said anything to you until now because I wanted to be sure that what I say comes from me, not from the mark's urging, not from gratitude, not from the relief of the wolf healing." A pause. "Those things are all real and all present, and I will not pretend otherwise. But they are not the whole of what this is, and you deserve to have me be certain before I came to you with it." She was quiet for a long time. Vareth had turned his great head and was watching the two of us with that amber patience that wolves have. "I am wolfless," she said. "Yes," I said. "Mate marks don't traditionally." "I know what the tradition says." I looked at her steadily. "My wolf chose you. Not my council, not my tradition, not the mating right and its candidates. Vareth chose you before I had the sense to. He usually does." She looked down at the brush in her hand, then up at the mark on my wrist, then at me. "You understand," she said carefully, "that everything they said about me, the hollowness, the being without a real heart, none of that has changed from their perspective. The moment this becomes known, the entire argument about her designation and her rank will." "I know," I said. "It will be a great deal worse than the clerk in the corridor." "I know. The council, the pack masters, the pack itself." She was not trying to talk me out of it. She was listing the full weight of it, steadily and without drama, the way she listed everything, so that I would know she had not missed any of it, and neither of us would be surprised. "Senna," I said, "I am not asking you to decide anything today. I am not asking you to accept the mark or the bond or anything else. I am telling you what is true, because you have been told things that were not true for most of your life, and I would rather stand in front of you with the full weight of what this is, every difficult thing, and have you make an informed choice than give you half of it and call myself honest." I lowered my sleeve slowly. "I am asking you, eventually and at whatever pace makes sense to you, to consider whether there is something between us that is worth your trust. That is all." She looked at me for a very long time. Then she said, "You didn't know me 4 weeks ago." "No," I said. "I walked past you in the corridor and I did not look." Her eyes didn't flinch from that. "And now?" "Now," I said, "I look. And I find that I have been looking for quite some time without having a name for it." A pause. "I find that I would like to hear what you think about every fable in that book. I find that I want to know what you see from every window in this keep, because you look at things and you find the blue in the snow, and you tell a grieving wolf about it, and he opens his eyes. I find that I have been in this room every morning for 4 weeks because it is the room where you are, and that when I am in it, I breathe differently than I do anywhere else in this building." I let that sit for a moment. "I find those things worth telling you about." She was quiet. Vareth pushed his great silver head gently against her arm, and her hand came up automatically and rested on his brow, and she stood there with her hand on my wolf and her gray eyes on me, and the lantern light between us. "I don't want to be a trophy," she said. "I don't want to be the story of the wolfless girl who won the king's bond, held up to prove a point about the pack's prejudice. I am not interested in being a reversal." "No," I said, "you are not a reversal. You are the person who came in with a pail and a stack of rags and sat on a cold stone floor for 11 minutes because a grieving wolf looked like he needed someone to sit with him. That is who you are. That is not a story about anyone else. She breathed in, she breathed out. She looked at the brush in her hand for a long moment, and then she set it down on the bench beside me, not a significant gesture, just a small, practical one, the way she did most things, and she looked at me directly. "You said eventually," she said. "Yes." "And at whatever pace makes sense." "Yes." She was quiet for another beat. Then, with the same calm honesty with which she had said everything else, "I find that I look for you in the mornings," she said. "Before you come down, I find that I talk to him, a brief glance at Verath about you sometimes, after you leave," a pause. "I didn't intend to tell you that." Something in my chest turned over. "I'm glad you did," I said. We stayed there in the quiet for a while, the keep moving over our heads, the morning routines, the staff, the council, the whole apparatus of Ironsgate and its demands. All of it up there and all of this down here. The stone and the lantern and the wolf and the warmth on my wrist that was steady and certain and patient, the way all the best things are. "I would like to see the North Hills," she said eventually. "The ones you told me he likes to run." "We could go in the spring," I said. She nodded in the way of someone filing a decision away. "Settled. Yes," she said, "we could."
Brilliant.
The council meeting that followed was not pleasant. I will not pretend it was. Aldrich and Edric and the two junior packmasters sat across from me with the arranged expressions of men who have prepared their arguments carefully and intend to make use of them, and they made use of them. She was wolfless. She was common staff. She had no bloodline of record. The bond was unverifiable to the council's satisfaction. There were other candidates. There were always other candidates. Candidates with wolves and lines and pack standing. Women who would serve the alliance interests of the North and the South and the Midlands. I let them speak. I let them complete their arguments in full, because these were my pack masters and they had served faithfully, and they deserved to be heard even when what they were saying was wrong. I let them speak also because I noticed, as they spoke, the particular quality of their discomfort. It was not cruelty. Aldrich was not a cruel man. Edric was not a cruel man. They were men who had built their understanding of the world on a set of rules that had always worked before, rules about bloodlines, about standing, about the visible marks of worth. And Senna was a problem that those rules did not have a solution for. They could not find the place in their ledger to put what had happened in the lower hall, and what could not be filed could not be trusted, and what could not be trusted produced arguments. I understood this. I had thought the same way once. I had built the system Brennan followed, after all. Then I said, "She healed Verath." A pause. "In 3 weeks," I said, "she undid 3 years of grief in my wolf that the Healers Guild could not touch, that I could not touch, that no intervention of rank or resource or council-approved method could touch. She sat on a stone floor and she waited and she saw him. Not the grief. Not the spectacle. Him." I looked around the table. "My wolf chose her before my mark did, and my mark has confirmed what Verath knew." I set my hand flat on the table with my sleeve rolled back, the mate mark lit gold and steady for all of them to see. "I am not asking the council's permission. I am telling the council what is true so that we may proceed accordingly." Aldrich looked at the mark for a long time. He was 61 years old and he had seen 3 kings and several crises, and he had the long, accurate memory of someone who has watched power make mistakes and learned to recognize when it isn't. He was quiet for a while. Then he said, "She is good with him. I saw her in the courtyard yesterday when he ran." "Yes," I said. Another long pause. Then Aldrich, with the air of a man setting down something heavy, "She should be formally introduced to the court." "She will be," I said. "I am arranging that." "Soon," he said. Not an ultimatum. A strong suggestion from a man who understood that the pack's talk did not diminish with time unless it was given something solid to replace it. Soon I agreed.
Willing.
There is one more thing I want to tell you about. It was 2 weeks later, on a clear cold morning with ice on the inner courtyard flags, and the first pale suggestion of a longer light in the sky that said spring was thinking about arriving. I came down early, earlier than usual, before she was there, before the morning staff were fully awake. I wanted to see how Vareth greeted the day on his own, without either of us in the room. What I found was this. He was already at the outer door of the enclosure, pushing it open with his great silver head, stepping out into the corridor, walking to the end of it and looking at the door to the small east courtyard with an expression of clear intention. He wanted to go out. He turned and looked at me. I opened the door. He went through at a trot and I followed, and in the courtyard the cold air was sharp and clean and the thin early light was turning the snow-covered stone walls to something pale and luminous, and Vareth lifted his head and took the air in long drafts and then, with the abruptness of a creature who has decided something, he ran. Up the courtyard to the far wall wheeled back to me. Twice, three times. His tail was up. His ears were forward. He was enormous and silver and entirely present, not the hollow vessel of grief he had been, but the wolf, my wolf, the one I had carried for 31 years, the one who had walked through a great hall full of war council and made them all go quiet simply by entering. He stopped in front of me, panting, and looked at me with those amber eyes. "Yes," I said, "I know." Senna came out 10 minutes later, drawn by the sound of him, no doubt, with her coat pulled on over her work dress and her hair not yet done, and when she saw him at full run she laughed again, that wide, unguarded laugh that she did not usually let anyone hear, and he skidded to a stop in front of her and sat, which was the most undignified thing I had ever seen a creature of his stature do, and she put both arms around his neck, and he pressed his great head into her shoulder. And I stood back against the wall and I thought, this is what I want. Not the ceremony, not the public claiming, not the version of this story where the council has voted and the pack has been informed and everything is in order. This. The courtyard in the early light, and Vareth running because it is morning and he is alive, and this woman laughing without reservation, and me here in it with both of them. She looked up and saw me, and she did not startle this time. She had stopped startling at my presence weeks ago. She just looked at me with those direct gray eyes and a warmth in them that she had stopped trying to be careful about, and she said, "He's ready for the hills." "Spring is 3 weeks out," I said. "He can wait 3 weeks," she said. "I've watched him wait. He's very good at it." A pause, a small, level smile. "We both are." I crossed the courtyard. I stopped in front of her, and Vareth got up from between us with the dignified casualness of a wolf who has accomplished what he came to do, and stepped aside, and I held out my right hand, the marked wrist, bare in the cold air, not to press it to anything, not to demand or command or invoke, but simply to offer, an open hand. She looked at it, then she looked at me, then she took my hand in both of hers, and she turned the marked wrist toward the morning light, and she looked at it the way she looked at the snow on the best mornings, with attention, with something like recognition, with the quiet wonder of a person who expected very little and has found something true. "I want to be clear," she said, "that I am choosing this, not because of the mark, not because of the rank. Because of the mornings," I said. She looked up at me. "Yes," she said, "because of the mornings." Vareth sat down beside us and put his nose in the air and breathed deeply, with every appearance of satisfaction.
Brilliant.
I introduced her to the court that evening. I will not tell you it was easy. The hall was lit and the council was in their seats and the whole apparatus of Ironskate was present, and I walked in with Senna at my side, not behind me, not at my shoulder in the position of an attendant, but at my side with the full bearing of someone who has agreed to be there, and I stopped at the head of the hall and I let the silence settle. Packmaster Aldrich was the first to bow. He was 61 years old and he had served my father, and he was not a man who bowed easily to anything he had not decided deserved it. He looked at Senna for a moment with the assessing, accurate eye of someone who has been watching power for decades, and then he inclined his head, fully, correctly, the bow of a pack master to his lady. And after him the hall followed, the whole ripple of it moving down the rows like the wind moving over still water. Senna stood beside me and received it without flinching. She did not perform humility or triumph. She simply stood, level and present, the way she had sat on the stone floor outside Vareth's enclosure on the first day, fully there, offering nothing she didn't mean. From the inner corridor beside the great hall, through the iron grate of the lower passage, I heard a long, low, resonant sound, Vareth adding his own voice to it. The hall went very still. And then, from somewhere near the back, one of the younger wolves, I think, one of the new staff who had joined since Senna came, a voice said quietly, "The wolf speaks for her." They did not look down at her. They looked at her, the wolfless girl from the eastern quarter who had come in with a pail and a stack of rags and had reached, without ceremony or title or the approval of anyone, straight to the heart of the thing no one else could touch. I reached for her hand. She let me take it. "She is my keeper," I said. "And she is my mate, and she is your lady, and she has been here in this keep, working without recognition or compensation or the ordinary dignity of being seen for 23 days before I corrected that error. I would not have her unnamed a day longer. I am not asking the pack to decide. I am asking the pack to know." The hall was quiet. Outside, Vareth's voice faded slowly into the northern air, unhurried, full, like a bell that has finally been rung. Senna squeezed my hand once, brief, private, not for the hall, just for me, and I turned and looked at her, and she was looking at the hall with those gray eyes, and there was something in her face that was not triumph and was not vindication and was not the look of someone watching a reversal pay out. It was simply peace. The expression of someone who has been called hollow for a very long time and has always known, without anyone to confirm it, that they were not. They confirmed it now, but that was not the point. The point was the morning light in the courtyard. The point was Vareth at full run, his tail high, his breath making clouds in the cold. The point was a pail set down on a stone floor and 11 minutes of patience, and the particular shade of blue and fresh snow that looks like the bottom of the sea. The point was that she had always been full of it, the warmth, the heart, the feeling the pack had decided she lacked, and she had simply been waiting for the room where it was wanted. She found it here, and so at last did I.
Brilliant.
We went to the North Hills in the spring. The road was 3 hours on horseback from Ironskate due north, through the pine-dark forest where the winter's last snow still lay in patches under the trees, and then up through the long open rise of the moorland where the sky came down wide and pale, and the new grass was pushing through the old brown cover in thin, bright lines. Senna rode easily, which surprised me until she told me she had grown up near the forest tracks of the eastern quarter and had learned to ride before she had learned to read, on a borrowed mare whose principal opinions were about speed and the direction of interesting smells. She told me this without ceremony, the way she told me most things, and I listened with the attention that I had discovered over the weeks I gave to almost everything she said, not because the content always required it, but because the experience of listening to her was simply different from the experience of listening to anyone else. She was exact. She described things with a kind of precise pleasure, the blue and the snow and the borrowed opinionated mare, and the way the pine trees changed character at a certain altitude, becoming shorter and more stubborn, as if the wind had spent centuries informing them of its views and they had decided to compact themselves in response. Vareth ran ahead of us most of the way. He checked back twice, appearing from the trees with his tongue out and his tail high, assessing us with the manner of a wolf who is very satisfied with how the morning is proceeding and wants to be sure we are maintaining a sufficient pace. Then he was gone again into the green and the silver and the distance. We reached the ridge at mid-morning. Vareth ran until the sky was all there was above him. No walls, no hold, nothing between him and the ridge line that stretched north to the edge of sight. We watched from the hill's crest, Senna with her hand in mine, and the wind in her hair and her face lifted to the pale spring sun. And below us the wolf ran and ran, because it was morning and he was alive and the season had turned, and grief, given the right company and the right patience, had found somewhere else to put itself at last. She said nothing for a long while. She just watched him run. Then she said, "I told him about this window." "In the beginning," I said, "when you were still outside the grate." "I told him there was a ridge you could just see on clear mornings," she said, "that it looked like a promise." We watched him reach the far end of the ridge and arc wide and come back, his silver coat catching the new light. "It does," I said. She turned and looked at me with those gray eyes, and the warmth in them was all the way open now, nothing held back, nothing braced for dismissal. "Yes," she said, "it does." Vareth came back to us at a run and leaned his great warm bulk against our joined hands, and we stood on the ridge in the first real light of spring and let the season come. I thought about the lower hall, the locked door and the lantern and the stone bench and the cold that never quite left the floor no matter how warm the days grew. I thought about 11 minutes on that floor and the sound of a wolf breathing differently for the first time in 3 years. I thought about all of it, the grief and the missing and the long gray weight of the days when doing my duty was the only reason to get up, and I thought, this is where it ended, not because the loss was less, not because I had stopped carrying it, but because something true had walked in with a pail and a stack of rags and had sat down on the floor and waited, and the waiting had been enough, and the truth of it had been enough, and here we were on the ridge in the spring. Senna put her head against my shoulder. It was a small thing, quiet and unhurried like all the things she did. She did not make it significant. She just leaned, and I put my arm around her, and Vareth sat down in the new grass at our feet with his tail moving slowly and his amber eyes on the distance, and we stayed like that for a long time, the three of us, in the full morning light. She said eventually, "It's exactly as you described." "Is it what you expected?" She thought about it honestly. "It's better," she said. "Descriptions are good, but they're not the thing." A pause. "The thing is better." I held her closer. She let me. Below us, Ironskate sat in its valley with its stone walls and its flags, and all its weight of ceremony and rank, and the old rules about who was worth a second look. Up here, the wind moved over the ridge grass, and Vareth breathed the new season in long, clean drafts. And none of it, none of the ledger, none of the distinctions, none of the middle space where people like her were supposed to stay, reached this high. "Thank you," I said, "for the floor and the 11 minutes. She lifted her head and looked at me. "You watch from the gallery." I counted the minutes. A pause, then, with the small level warmth that was her version of something enormous, "You were always going to come down," she said. "You just needed the courage." She was right. She was exactly right, as she usually was. I looked at her, and the mark on my wrist was warm and steady and entirely at peace, and I thought, yes, I was always going to come down. It just took me until I had something worth coming down for. "Next year," I said, "we bring the whole pack up here." She considered this. Vareth would like that. "Vareth would be insufferable," I said. "He'd want to run every single one of them into the ground just to prove he still could." She laughed, that wide, unguarded laugh. It went out across the ridge and the grass and the pale spring sky and faded into the distance, warm and easy, like something that had been here all along and was only just now being heard. End.